Philadelphia, San Jose, or DC, Los Angeles, Galaxy.
Beach Pass.
Colorado Rapids. Vancouver Whitecaps. Seattle Sounders. Montreal Impact. Chivas USA. New York Red Bulls.
Pitch Pass, your all-access credential to the people that matter in MLS. Here's your host, Greg Roach.
Do yourself a favor. Keep an eye on pitchpass.com for the next week. We're putting together something interesting that we will talk about with our second guest. In the meantime, make sure you're following us on Twitter at PitchPass. Oh, hi, by the way. I know, we're just jumping in and we're all business. A lot going on, a lot to talk about. We will go over the U.S. men's national team's fantastic month with Boston Herald, Goal.com, FoxSports.com, MLSWriter.com, or MLSSoccer.com's Kyle McCarthy, one of the most plugged-in guys, one of the guys that I feel knows the most top to bottom about MLS. He will join us later on in the show, but first, we head out to San Jose. He is a defender for the Earthquakes. His name's Justin Morrow. He joins us right now on Pitch Pass. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're probably the smartest guy we've ever had on the show, so I've got to really think out the questions, Justin, before I ask you everything.
I think you're overestimating me.
I guess my first question would probably be about the loan process, because you are a big loan process success story. And I've always wondered how it kind of goes down behind the scenes. So take us back a couple of years as you started off your professional career, and then you were loaned out to a couple of teams.
Yeah, my rookie year here in San Jose, I hadn't been playing much, but I think Frank Yelup saw the potential in me that I could be good in the future and just needed a little bit of development, a little bit of games. And so he sent me over to Tampa, who had me for about a month and a half, and I got to play about, I think it was 4 or 5 games in a very short period of time. So it's just about getting those games under your belt. And it's kind of a good sign because it shows that, you know, they think that you have the potential there, but you might need some games. So that's kind of the way I took it, the mentality I took going into it.
Well, you can look back now because of where you are, but at the time there wasn't any, really? You're getting rid of me? You're shipping me out?
No, I didn't. I never felt like that, especially because it was only a month and a half. But I think it's very important the way players go into it, if they're loaned out, going in with a good mentality, just thinking that it's going to help them and not having the mentality, like you said, being too worried about it.
Well, how about the other side of the coin? Is it the situation in the league such where you, at the time, a young player, could go into your coach and say, hey, I'm not really getting a lot of minutes here. Is there something we can work out where I can be loaned out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of teams will work with players like that. That wasn't the case with me, but I have heard of that in the past, and I didn't think that would be a problem.
Let's talk about Frank Yelup since you brought him up. And I'm going to ask you just for a yes or no answer for the first question. And the question is, were you shocked when everything went down and Frank Yelup left San Jose?
Yes, I was shocked.
Shocked.
I think we were all very shocked. I don't think anyone saw it coming.
Well, I mean, the reason I guess I asked you the way I asked you is because, you know, we're still on the outside kind of scratching our head at the situation. And so maybe if you had said no, my follow-up might have been a little bit more of a tiptoey, ooh, okay, he was in shock, so something must have been going on. But, you know, based on what we read from a lot of the players and in the interviews and even their personal reactions on Twitter, it did seem like it was a, really? Wow, this is coming out of left field type of situation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we had been going through a bad stretch, but that doesn't, you know, Frank didn't turn into a bad coach over a stretch of 3 or 4 games, you know, that we lost, so it was pretty shocking. And I mean, as much as you guys know about it, probably as much as we know about it, maybe a little bit more, but it was all pretty crazy.
Well, you know how this goes down when you're in school and they have a teacher who, usually it's when they go out on maternity leave, the principal has to come in and say, well, she's not going to be here anymore. And this did that happen with you guys, or did Frank actually come in and make a little bit of a speech before he said his goodbyes?
Yeah, he said his goodbyes. He didn't give a reason at all. He just said that he wasn't going to be our coach anymore, and he just said goodbye to each one of us personally, and that was it.
And now, how are things under your interim coach, Mark Watson?
It's been great. I mean, Mark's been with the team since I've been with the team, and you know, he really understands a lot of the players, and he has confidence in us, and I think we have confidence in him.
And you couldn't have asked for a better start, 2-1 on the road against Colorado in his first game in charge.
Yeah, it was a good way to start fresh and get a win, and now we can try and build some momentum going into the next game.
And it's an interesting situation because, again, we don't know what's going on and the circumstances behind Yollop leaving, but if he wanted to, there's a lot of reasons why this year didn't get off to the start that last year got off to, and number one, of course, being all the injuries that you guys have had.
All right. So yeah, I think, you know, it's always a weird subject because every team in the MLS has injuries. I think every team could make excuses, and maybe it wasn't what we desired, but it's the situation we're in now, and we're going to work our way out of it.
I wanted to ask you who, if you're rooting for the Heat.
If I'm rooting for the Heat? No, absolutely not.
So you're a Clevelander who has cut all ties with LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I still like watching LeBron because he's a great basketball player. But just, you know, with everything that happened in Cleveland, just it kind of felt like a brother was leaving you. You know, and I had watched him in high school and heard about him for in middle school even. So just knowing that he was our hometown guy and then him leaving like that just hurt a little bit.
You know, I didn't even think about that. You guys are not the same age, but you're very close in age, so you probably have had him in your life as at least as kind of an urban legend for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what people don't understand when they don't understand like how it hurts. You know, I think it's exactly that. I mean, I was reading about this guy on the like listening to it on the news, reading about him when he was literally in middle school. So
yeah,
just like you said, he was. I had heard about him for a very long time. So yeah, it hurt.
Yeah, and then so because I think a lot of people, I know I do. You look at the situation, you go, okay, he was drafted to play for Cleveland, so that's why they're taking it so hard. But it's not just that; it's like, you know, your hometown guy also saying, "No, thank you, I'm going somewhere else."
Yeah, exactly.
So are you not? So you're not rooting for the Heat? We can put that on record.
Yes, I'll put that on record.
I wanted to ask you about your time in the national team camp because, you know, basically 18 months ago, you were not a full-time starter for your team. And the next thing you know, you're trotting out representing your country. How big of a whirlwind was that for you? And how awesome was it to line up against Canada and representing the United States?
Yeah, it was pretty incredible just the way everything happened. But I just kept on trying to take it one step at a time, you know, not get too far in front of myself. And I was happy with the way I handled everything, and I was so proud and honored to be able to be in that camp and do well and get a start, like you said, get a cap.
And I, in the back of your mind, now that you have had that taste of what it's like in national team camp, do you still feel like, okay, I went out there, I impressed, I feel like I impressed, I did well in front of Jurgen Klinsmann. My door for 2014 is not closed yet as far as representing the United States at the World Cup.
I still feel like that a little bit. I know there's huge competition going on with any of the defenders in the national team camp right now, and there's a bunch of left backs who are doing well. So I just go out and try and compete every day, and I know that if I'm doing that and I'm giving it my all, I can't regret anything.
How much of your success do you attribute to the cutting of the dreads?
A lot of success, actually. I think that was the number one success.
You know, it's weird. I'm a former long-haired myself, and
okay.
I probably maybe 2 or 3 months before I cut my hair was over the hair, and I was like, I definitely want to cut it. But then when you get those scissors up there, it's like, no. Actually, I'm going to wait. Was it like that for you?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, like you said, I was over it a little bit. I think I had extended the period for it a little bit too long, but it's always tough when you have
yeah,
going out for years or whatever. You don't want to get rid of it. drastic change.
But then I imagine playing, say, in Houston in August, you think to yourself, thank God that hair is gone.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even think about it now.
So there's no plans to even grow it out a little bit now. You're close-cropped for good.
Yeah, I wouldn't say for good. I mean, when I'm a soccer player, I'll always change it up at some point. But for right now, I'm good with the short hair.
Well, Justin, thank you very much for checking in. You guys have DC United this weekend. So, I mean, I guess this is a good time maybe to start getting the ball rolling and start picking up some of those points that you dropped earlier in the season.
Yeah, I mean, it was our first road win this past weekend, and so we're not getting ahead of this next game. You know, DC is a tough opponent. They're going to come in scrapping and clawing for everything, so we have to understand that we've only had one win on the road and go and try and get some momentum and do it again.
Appreciate you taking the time, Justin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Justin Morrow of San Jose Earthquakes. And we talked a little bit about U.S. men's national team and his time in the national team during the January camp. But let's actually focus on this past June and everything that it meant for the national team and their quest to make it to Brazil. To do that, we bring in the Boston Herald's Golds.com, just a jack of all trades as far as writing is concerned. The great Kyle McCarthy joins us now. Kyle, how are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing, man?
Well, Kyle, we just had Justin Morrow on, so I did tease we were going to talk a little national team stuff, but since we were just talking about San Jose Earthquakes, I wanted to get your vibe on this Frank Yollop situation, because it's pretty puzzling if you're just kind of looking at the situation as an outside observer.
Yeah, if you look at it just from how things unfolded, San Jose won the Supporters' Shield last season, and Frank Yollop is out of a job halfway through the next season. And that sort of stuff doesn't happen in MLS very often. Clubs exhibit a lot of patience with their coaches, and they tend to stick around for a while. And obviously, Yollop had a great run with the Earthquakes, but the fact that those two parties decided to part ways is a bit surprising.
And the part ways thing is what is the confusing part, because if it was fired, you could say, all right, he's fired. If it was resigned, you could say, all right, resigned. But the part ways thing leaves it so ambiguous. And, you know, I asked Justin if he was shocked at Yollop leaving, and he said, yes, I was. So it wasn't even a situation where the players were maybe kind of starting to grumble that there was a problem. This came out of left field.
Yeah, and I think part ways is one of those PR things where, you know, maybe parting ways also means, well, why don't you, you know, not let the door hit you on the way out. It's tough to get a grasp of that. I mean, I can't see this sort of move happening without some discomfort on both sides. Yollop has been there for a long time, and certainly he's going to want to try and push on during the summer and bring in new players. And the management obviously has some bones to pick as well at this point, when you've got a team that's struggling on the field, albeit one that's been racked with injuries, and a team that does not play a particularly pleasing style of soccer. So there are considerations on both sides, and I think that's why, in this case at least, the jargon may actually fit a little bit.
Are we in a situation here where we're just all waiting for the other shoe to drop, and that would be Frank Yollop's future plan, so that we can all then go, oh, okay, that's why it happened?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, but I think there's a part of it that won't be explained unless some people on both sides start talking about what actually happened. It's surprising to see Frank Yollop exit in this sort of fashion. I think he certainly deserved the full year if he wanted it to turn this team around. And how that whole thing unfolded, I think, is going to be something that those parties are going to have to shed some light on in the future.
Yeah, and you brought it up that this doesn't really happen that often in MLS. And I think one of the reasons is teams are loath to pay a coach for not coaching the team. And that's why the parted ways, again, brings up that ambiguousness where it's like, okay, well, are they still going to pay him, or what's going on here? And, you know, like we were just saying, this is going to be something where I kind of want to see what happens next, because there is another shoe to drop.
Yeah, we'll have to see. It'll be something worth monitoring during the summer, particularly because Yollop is now the outstanding candidate on the MLS coaching market. Does this move prompt another ownership group to maybe make a move with his own manager and try and bring Frank Yelp in at some point during the summer? That's a question worth watching.
Now, let's get back into MLS in just a minute. I do want to ask you, since it's all fresh in our minds, about the recent run of games for the U.S. men's national team, culminating, at least for the June qualifiers, with the 1-0 victory over Honduras in Utah or at Rio Tinto. We're putting together something at pitchpass.com that you're going to be participating in, and that is a kind of like a preliminary list of the 23 players you would think would be on the roster for World Cup 14 in Brazil. As I'm starting to put my list together in my head, Kyle, I'm thinking to myself, there's no chance that any of the Germans get left off. And that's for better or for worse. And you know where I'm leading up to with that question, which is the Jeff Cameron versus Jermaine Jones situation. And again, how it played out yesterday. Is there any chance that Jeff Cameron leapfrogs Jermaine Jones in Jurgen Klinsmann's hierarchy?
Now, there's still a year between now and the World Cup, and there's still a lot of games to be played at that point. I think for me, it's difficult to really say, you know, Jermaine Jones is going to be on the field, assured starter, a year from now. I know Jurgen Klinsmann likes him, but a year is a long time, and a lot of things can happen. So will Jeff Cameron play regularly with Stoke this year with Mark Hughes coming in? Will Jones play regularly at Schalke? There are a lot of variables in the mix right now. I hesitate to say that Jermaine Jones is going to be a dead certain starter when the U.S. presumably takes the field in Brazil in about a year.
But does Klinsmann give him every opportunity to solidify that spot, I guess is what I'm asking?
I think Klinsmann has shown enough pragmatism over the past 6 to 12 months to say that he will get an opportunity. Whether it's an even opportunity is another story, because, like you said, Klinsmann does like Jermaine Jones a great deal. And Jermaine Jones, I realize he's often criticized by American soccer observers, but he contributes a lot on the field. He's an important part of what the Americans are trying to do at the moment. So whether he falls out of the team, I think it's going to be something dictated by his own displays and his own health over the next year or so.
All form and injuries aside, and let's put Terrence Boyd aside as well, because he really hasn't established himself on the senior side yet. Which of the four Germans, and I'm thinking of Chandler, Johnson, Jermaine Jones, and Danny Williams, do you feel has the best chance of not being on the roster of those four?
Right now, I would say it's Danny Williams. He has slipped out of the team a little bit over in Germany. He has suffered with some injuries, and he's a guy who plays in a spot where Jurgen Klinsmann has a lot of depth. He is a holding midfielder through and through. And if he is not in the right form, he's not in the right shape, then he's in trouble. And when you look at that holding midfield role, and you look at how Klinsmann's going to have to assemble a 23-man roster, if he can use Jeff Cameron in that spot, that could free him up to drop Danny Williams and bring in another versatile player somewhere else within his squad. So for me at the moment, I think Williams is the guy to watch there.
I'm splitting hairs, obviously. It was a great run in June after the Belgian match. If I did have something that concerned me about yesterday's match, and again, even in Panama, which wasn't really in doubt, I'm a little nervous about the U.S. tendency to not be able to absolutely step on the throat of an opponent and kill off a match. Is that something I need to be concerned about, or am I overreacting?
I think it's a little bit of an overreaction. I also don't think it's a situation where the U.S. is going to find itself very much when it gets to Brazil. I mean, this is a U.S. team that is a solid, disciplined outfit. They've got some strengths, they've got some weaknesses, and they're going to stay in matches. The question for them is whether they can grind out games like they did against Honduras in Utah last night, or whether you're going to shoot themselves in the foot by making an untimely mistake or two. I think that's more the focus rather than trying to put teams away, because I don't think when you get to the World Cup, that sort of scenario is going to come into play.
And that's the funky thing to do when you're watching the team play is that the way they have to play in CONCACAF, well, first off, let's go the way they play in CONCACAF, they have to play differently on the road than they do at home, just because the CONCACAF teams generally tend to play almost 100% better at home than they do on the road. But then, however they play in CONCACAF, they have to play completely different once they get to the World Cup, because that stage and those teams are completely different. And that's the hard thing for me to judge, because the team that I kind of passionately follow outside the United States is the Netherlands. They play the same way every single time because you're going to conform to them, or the game's just not happening. Whereas the U.S., they have to play the CONCACAF Central American countries, and then they have to play the teams that they play, like the Germanys and the Belgiums of the world.
And those sorts of scenarios present a whole different set of circumstances that the U.S. needs to navigate. And when you look at this U.S. team going onto the world stage, it's a side that is going to have to react to the strengths of other teams. That's just how it's going to work, because of what the U.S. has to offer and what other teams have to offer. So for Klinsmann and his players at this point, it's a matter of accentuating the positives and finding a way to establish that firm base that will make them difficult to play against when it comes to Brazil next year.
Long term, and when I long term, I mean going into the next calendar year, we go back and forth about which center back we love or have the most confidence in, and lately it's been Gonzalez and Beisler. Which of those two now do you have the most confidence in?
Beisler. I have more confidence in Beisler than I do in Gonzalez at this point. Two issues with Gonzalez that concern me. His tendency to get caught drifting inside his own area. He doesn't always stick to his marker, and that's the sort of thing that kills you, that momentary lapse at a World Cup. And two, his distribution. He has improved a bit with the ball at his feet, but he's still a real liability when the ball is at his feet and he's trying to play a decent pass out of the back. And again, it's the sort of situation where the U.S. cannot afford mistakes as the intensity of the task increases. And I think for Gonzalez over the next year or so, he's going to have to work on ironing some of that stuff out if he wants to be in the starting lineup in the U.S.'s first World Cup match.
Is it even more of a feather in the U.S. cap to pull these 9 points that they've gotten in the last rematch, considering, and I don't think a lot, maybe it hasn't really been something that I've read a lot about, is the outside back situation. I mean, Klinsmann was basically cutting and pasting any spare part that he could into both sides of the U.S. outside defense.
Yeah, and I think it is something that has kind of fallen a little bit below the radar. And Klinsmann has done a nice job of turning to versatile players, DeMarcus Beisler, Brad Evans, obviously, in this instance, to fill the void at fullback. But it also points out the lack of depth in that spot right now. I mean, you would think the right side would be okay with Timmy Chandler and Steve Cherundolo going forward. But that left back spot, if Fabian Johnson's going to play in midfield, Jurgen Klinsmann's got to find some cover at left back. And if he is deciding to slide Fabian Johnson back into the rear guard and not start Edgar Castillo at home against Honduras, I think that says a lot about where he feels like he is at the left back spot right now. So for me, I think there are still some questions to answer at fullback, but the fact that the U.S. was able to get through these games, collect 9 points, and really put together good defensive performances shows its ability to adapt to some of those problems that crop up along the way.
I've almost forgotten what I can expect from Timmy Chandler, because it's been so long since he's been on the field. And he's one of those guys that I think we were talking about CONCACAF style versus world stage style. He's one of those guys that I think doesn't look as good in CONCACAF as he would in a world stage setup. Do you agree with that?
I do. CONCACAF is a mess. It's a mopkin, it's a mire, and it's the sort of place where players with skill tend to find themselves obscured. Look at Mexico right now. Mexico is making an almighty mess of trying to qualify for the World Cup. It's not because of talent. They've got plenty of players who are good with the ball at their feet and who can carve out open opposing defenses, but they've struggled to really produce the sort of grit and the sort of determination necessary to overcome the tasks placed in front of them. And I think it's the same sort of thing with Chandler. When you get him onto a world stage, when you get him into a World Cup scenario where technique is a little bit of a higher priority, I think he's the sort of guy who can help you when he's overlapping from his fullback spot.
How much are we counting on Steve Cherundolo these days?
You know, it's a good question. And I think at this point, it's a little bit hit or miss. I think he's a guy who might have to provide depth at this stage of his career, not necessarily a guy who is going to be on the field and starting in the next year or so. I mean, he's a guy who has done a great job for his country. He's been a solid veteran, solid cog in the wheel, but whether he's going to be on the field in 12 months' time, that's very difficult to project because you just don't know with a player of his age how quickly that drop-off is going to come. And if it comes too quickly, Jurgen Klinsmann is going to have a very difficult decision to make.
Last thing on the national team before we go back into MLS, if you take, like I said, form and injuries and put them aside, is the biggest storyline now for the rest of the summer outside of Gold Cup and which one of those guys may raise their hands as being wanting to play on the A team for the national team? Is it Jozy Altidore's transfer situation and him finding the right setup to continue growing and maturing as a player?
I think it's 1 and 1A. I think Altidore is right in the mix, and I think Landon Donovan is going to continue to be a storyline going into the summer. But on Josie's front, I think it's crucial that he makes the right move this summer. He cannot afford to transfer to a club and sit on the bench for the European season. He cannot afford to halt the development that he's had this year and stop the rhythm that he's generated from scoring goals on a regular basis in Holland. So the key for him is to choose wisely in his transfer and pick the right club if he ultimately decides to leave us yet.
And I think the thing that we as outsiders don't fully invest in or comprehend is the double-edged sword of the professional athlete. I mean, we all know that these guys have small windows to earn the money that is going to have to support them for their lives, in the case of Jozy Altidore with these big money transfers. So we can't just think of it as, oh, well, why would he go there? He's not playing. It's got to be a situation that's right for him financially and also a situation that's right for him where he's going to play for the World Cup.
Absolutely. And there are certainly a lot of different factors to consider when you're making a transfer move. And it's also one of the reasons why I always hesitate to call an MLS player overpaid. Because in the grand scheme of world football, they're not.
Yeah.
MLS players are not paid at a particularly high level. And, you know, when you look at Jozy and how he is compensated in comparison to his production, it's probably not on the level that you would expect. So he has to really evaluate as he's going forward, what are his priorities over the next 6 to 12 months and how can he best pursue them? Is it the money? Is it the right competitive situation? Is it a place where he has to concede a little bit on his weekly wage packet in order to ensure everything goes according to plan? It's a very difficult situation for any person to cope with. But for Altidore, the pressure and the stakes increase tenfold going into a World Cup year.
Well, let me ask you about Landon because you brought him up. Is it really just a matter of Landon playing the good soldier and playing at Gold Cup and then fulfilling his penance to Jurgen Klinsmann? Or does he need to do something on the field to get back in the good graces of Klinsmann?
I think it's both. I think Donovan can still contribute more on the field for the Galaxy right now. You see him in fits and starts influencing games. You don't see him consistently dominating as everyone knows he can do at the MLS level. He needs to reach that point in order to mandate his inclusion. And once he mandates his inclusion, then the pennant starts to come into play. Then the fact that he's willing to go to the Gold Cup and play with players that he's not really expecting to play with at the international level and spend his summer trying to win the Gold Cup, then that thing sort of matters a little bit more. So It'll be interesting to see how this unfolds over the next couple of months, but Landon Donovan is a guy who is going to remain in the consciousness of the American soccer public as the World Cup approaches, and now it's just a matter of what his role is going to be in that buildup.
And I think over a lot of people, the best case scenario is Landon Donovan for the rest of the summer and then reassumes his place in the starting lineup. But is a more realistic scenario that Graham Zusi has a lock on that spot and Landon Donovan is a 70th minute super sub, for lack of a better word?
That's certainly a scenario. You could also see him maybe slide onto the left if Klinsmann has some issues at left back and Fabian Johnson has to go back and play in defense. But I think at this stage in his career, Landon Donovan might be best suited to a role where he can come on in the second half and change the game in the 60th, 65th minute and really use that final 30 minutes to really stamp his mark on a match. It's going to be a situation that will evolve over the next six to 12 months as Donovan finds his footing and Klinsmann weighs how exactly he wants to use him. But I think there's a role for Landon Donovan. It's just a matter of figuring out what's best for him and what's best for the national team.
Landon Donovan and LA Galaxy take on Chivas USA on Sunday. Can we petition MLS to take the word super out of the Super Classico moving forward?
It's certainly not super. It can't be super at this point, not with the way Chivas USA is playing. Not with the way that Chivas USA is basically comporting itself as an organization at the moment. I mean, LA should win that game and should win that game handily. With one caveat, Chivas USA going through a coaching change at this point.
Yeah.
So you're never quite sure how teams will react to a different man in charge. But I look at that Chivas USA roster and the strip mining that Chivas Guadalajara is planning to do to it. And I can't really see a way back for this Chivas USA team.
And that was my question for Chivas USA. What's going on with this strip mining, as you called it, with Chivas Guadalajara? Two players, Eric Avila being the big name player, leaving for Chivas Guadalajara with what sort of compensation and what sort of role is he going to have as he leaves Chivas USA? How is this doable or possible in MLS rules?
MLS-centric people tend to forget that Chivas Guadalajara rules the roost in that organization. Chivas USA is great. It's nice. It helps out in America, I guess, when everything's going well. But everything in the Chivas organization is centered on making the Guadalajara team better. So if you have Eric Avila and you have Giovanni Casillas and you think that they can strengthen the first team in Guadalajara, then you move the pieces around and find a way to satisfy MLS contractually and send them on their way to Mexico. And for the players, it makes a lot of sense because they probably get a pay bump when they cross the border. Because, you don't have to worry about the salary budget at that point. So for me, I think it's something MLS is going to have to take a real serious look at and determine whether this is the sort of arrangement that really makes sense for a league that should be beyond this
yes.
at this point.
Yes, and to me, as an MLS-centric guy, an MLS snob, that's what bothers me the most is, you know what, this isn't 1998 or 1999 where you're just happy to have a big club like Chivas a part of this league. This shouldn't be a situation where any team in this league should just be a minor league farm system for another club in the world, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing situation, and it's going to be an issue when New York City FC takes the field as well, because you're not quite sure how the folks in Manchester are going to treat their team in New York. Is it going to be a scenario where that is a standalone club with its own identity, or is it going to be an offshoot of Manchester City? Both of those options are on the table, and a blend of those two options is on the table. For MLS at this point, the worst thing is to be seen as something lesser.
Yeah.
MLS is a league that needs to stand on its own two feet. And there's plenty within MLS to celebrate. There's plenty within MLS to cherish. It's just a matter of trying to sell it. And it gets very difficult to make the case for MLS when you see some of this tomfoolery going on.
We had Lee Wynn on last week, I think, on the show, and we were just talking. For me, it was a surprise, and you know this, Kyle. For a long time, New England by no means was the worst team in MLS, but you could make a case that they were definitely one of the more boring teams. I know, looking at MLS Live or on my or Direct Kick, whenever I saw New England, I'd be like, oh, okay, I can skip that match and watch another one. Tides have turned significantly this year, and to me, they're one of the most exciting teams in the league. How frustrating was it for them? And I don't know if you had a chance to talk to the guys. I know you were with them when they played in the friendly the other day. How difficult was it for them, or frustrating for them, to get off to such a high flying start against Vancouver and then have that sending off and everything going off the rails?
Yeah, it was obviously disappointing. That's a game that, if Andrew Farrell doesn't get sent off, that the Revolution are going to win.
Yeah.
And they're going to probably win by 3 or 4 goals with the way that match was unfolding. And, hey, we might be talking on this podcast about a new coach in Vancouver. We might have already solved the Frank Yellow conundrum. But instead, you know, Andrew Farrell gets sent off, and then the Revs really fail to adjust to the situation and ship 3 goals before halftime. And all of a sudden, you know, a good performance turns into some defeat that's just ends up being perplexing. And I think that gets frustrating because this team over the past couple of years under the Jay Heaps regime has talked about getting on runs and being able to string together a series of results on a regular basis to really thrust themselves into playoff contention. They had done that over the past few weeks, and then to lose it in that sort of scenario was pretty difficult.
And then have to sit on it now for a week as they are on their bye week.
Yes. The good news for them is that they go to Chivas USA for their next league game. So, I mean, that's got to be a little bit of a positive. But they have to sit on it, and then they have to get involved with the U.S. Open Cup quarterfinal at D.C. United next week, which is going to be a very difficult game considering at this point United has nothing else to play for before the end of the season. So, you know, there's a lot going on with the Revs at this point. They'll rest up this weekend and then tackle the Open Cup and then head to California. It's going to be a little bit of a tricky fortnight for them.
Yeah, but I think this is a good run for them. And I talked to Lee Wynn about it, and I focused in on that Real Salt Lake match at Foxborough, where they just a little bit of their youth kind of came out. And I think the same thing happened, as you were alluding to, of the not being able to adjust to going down a man in Vancouver. But these are part of the growing pains that I think a team on the up or on the come have to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. Oddly enough, in that whole entire stretch, the one game that I looked toward as a sign of the Revs' improvement was that 0-0 draw against DC United. Now, it was a turgid game, and the Revs should have come away with 3 points. But last year, the Revs are finding a way to lose that game. And the fact that they were able to get out of there with a point, manage the game productively, represents a step forward for them, as odd as that sounds. And if they can ally that sort of miserliness, which they've shown throughout the season, with one or two exceptions, with the constitution to churn out results on a regular basis, this is a team that can really push for a playoff berth during the second half of the season.
I know you're going to be a little biased, but I will ask you, are they the biggest surprise to you this year, or is it FC Dallas?
Not even close. Yeah, no, it's for me, it's actually Portland. I think Portland's the biggest surprise, followed by FC Dallas, and I would put the Reds a little bit farther down the list, actually. I think for me, Portland coming into this season, this was always going to be a transition year for them. They were not supposed to produce results. They were supposed to take a year, figure out how to operate within Caleb Porter's system, and then maybe next year really take that step forward and push toward the playoffs. I could not have expected Portland to produce the sort of results they have this year. Sure, there's a lot of draws mixed in there, but they've been a good, solid unit. A couple of defensive wobbles, but they're very good going forward. And they've really turned themselves from a team that wasn't all that pleasing on the eyes to a team that keeps the ball on the floor and moves it around very well. So for me, I think Portland's the top surprise. I think FC Dallas is right up there with the way that Shelf Hyman has turned that team around. And Montreal has to be on the list as well, just with the way that they've been able to play. And and the results they've been able to post under Marco Schalabom. So I think before you even get to the Revs, I think there were at least three, four, or five teams that would probably register higher on that scale.
That's nice of you to say that. I like that, Kyle. That's your team, and I like that you were able to do it objectively.
You know, I think objectivity is important, and I think it's something that we kind of lose in the sort of media landscape that we're in today that kind of rewards partisanship. I think objectivity is critical, and for me, I see other teams that are more surprising than the Revs right now.
And, you know, the weird thing is, for me, I still am going to continue with New England because in my mind, going into the season, it was same old New England. And I know the players they acquired, but they weren't known entities in MLS. And the guys who were known, the Lee Wins of the world, we had seen what had happened last year. So to me, it was like, oh, okay, more of the same from New England. Whereas with Portland, you knew Caleb Poehler was coming in. You knew there was going to be a different mentality. And you kind of could have guessed either way whether it was going to succeed now or later. But at some point, it probably would have been successful. Dallas has a lot of interesting pieces. Their defense, the guys up front that they have, and they had some question marks, but you could tell that they had some things going on. And Montreal just was a veteran team that was kind of frisky towards the end of last year and added some really nice pieces. So that's why I would go with New England over those teams. Obviously, you can't argue with your reasoning because they're all sound, because they are all they're all better than New England as far as points are concerned.
Yeah, no, and your point on New England is well taken. I mean, Jay Heaps and Michael Burns have done a good job with the roster in terms of the turnover from last year to this year. If you look at, you know, at the Revs 1-18 from 2012 and the Revs 1-18 from 2013, there is no comparison.
Yeah.
This team is much deeper, it's much stronger. And you can see that by the uptick in the results. The question for them, and it has been throughout all last year and all of this year, is whether they can get the necessary production from those top three or four guys, the 1, 2, 3, 4 on that roster. And with Juan Agudelo's arrival, they're starting to get that production. And with Diego Fagundes starting to find his footing in MLS, you're starting to get that production. The question is whether they can sustain it over a long summer.
Kyle, always great to talk to you, my friend. I don't know anybody who knows more about MLS top to bottom than you do, so thank you for hanging with us. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Anytime.
For more show information, go to pitchpass.com.